Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, April 23rd, 2015. And tonight I'm going to be doing an alternative energy update, some interesting things going on. First of all, a couple quick announcements, and I noticed last week's show I ran too far in the announcements, so I'm going to try desperately to keep them limited to maybe a max of 5 minutes. Anyway, a few quick announcements. Verizon's still blocking my website. If you have Verizon, dump them. Also, Google putting my mail, now this is my business mail, into the trash bin, even though many people have me set as a VIP for passing the mail and not being dumped in the trash. So anyway, if you have Gmail, get rid of them. If you want to get mail from me, also Verizon, dump Verizon. Who knows what their problem is, but we know that they know about it. The technicians at Verizon have been able to go in and determine what the problem is. There is a blockage in Verizon. They've been able to cure it for some customers, but then they tell them, don't tell anybody I did this for you. We're not supposed to. So they know about this. This is a well-known problem, block Jim McCanny's website in Verizon. Just a quick announcement about NASA continues with these alien announcements. Very bizarre. I don't think I had time to get this into last week's show, but they had an announcement that they had discovered alien life, transmissions from afar, from the galaxy that were alien extraterrestrial signals. It turned out, they announced later, that it was due to when you open your microwave oven. Now, this is the Parkes Telescope in Australia. That they, this is just so bizarre. They've announced that they expect to find intelligent life within the next 10 to 25 years. That was another announcement that just came out. They're confident they're going to find intelligent life. But let me just point something out here. If you look at, let's say, just the window of opportunity to get signals from planet Earth, if you were an alien in some other part of the galaxy, looking for some kind of signals, either directed at us or just directed somewhere else in outer space, remember that when you beam information, it's at a satellite. It's a very narrow beam. So it's like we would have to be transmitting directly at that star. It's not like they're going to pick up, the Sunday night television show with their radio telescopes on that distant star in our galaxy. Plus, here's the limiting factor. We have only had transmission, radio transmission, of the type that would be detectable in the far reaches of the galaxy. We've only had this type of capability for maybe 20 years. Radio telescopes go back to the early part of the 1900s. They were seriously developed during World War II, and then the scientific advancements after that. I think I told the story about the development of the discovery of neutron stars and pulsars, what are known as pulsars. In other words, they're a very brief but intense radio signal that were discovered during World War II as a part of the radio transmissions that were going on at the time. But at any rate, cut that short, but just what is all of this announcement coming out of NASA, false announcements, colored and tainted announcements, and then a prediction that in 10 years they will discover extraterrestrial life? Maybe they're just looking for funding. But at any rate, I think we're going to see more of that. Let me continue a point here. This is important. I didn't really finish my thought when talking about NASA looking for aliens. If you're looking for aliens out there, remember that catastrophes are something that occur regularly on planets as part of the normal formation of solar systems, of stellar systems, planetary systems. And so the window in which a civilization can become advanced, get off the planet, and not only get off the planet, but get large populations off the planet so they survive, is very limited. And what's the possibility, like, for example, on Earth, we're not doing a very good job here. We're not doing a good job of getting large populations into space. In fact, the whole purpose of NASA is to keep you from going into space. So the point is that when we're looking out there and imagining that there is intelligent life on other planets in a solar system or stellar system, planetary system far, far away in the galaxy, there might be only a 200-year window. And out of the past, you know, billion years, what's the possibility that that civilization is going to be up and running when we are up and running? And, for example, if we detected an alien civilization far, far away, would we signal back and say, here we are? No, I think in general, the intelligent, if you really want to specify what is intelligent, you would say an intelligent species is one that would not allow radio signals to go out and be heard by some other intelligent species far out in the galaxy, because they could come and take all your resources, kill off all the population, and wouldn't allow you to get off your planet. So signaling other civilizations is not a good idea, if you understand what I mean. And so one thing that we have not learned on Earth collectively, I mean, it's something I have learned, it's something many scientists have spoken about, hey, NASA, don't go out there blasting radio signals all over the place, because that could allow us to be detected by other not-so-friendly alien civilizations and cause the demise of our planet before we ever got up and running. So very stupid to be sending signals out into outer space, like, hey, here we are, everybody, look at us, you know, we're advanced, come and take everything we have, we're NASA, we're real smart. At any rate, that's the point, is that there's a very brief window of opportunity to detect those civilizations, and what is the possibility that they are in a state like we are at the very same time. If you take a billion-year window and you take maybe a 20-year window out of there, that intelligent life would get up to the point where they're signaling and then not realizing that they shouldn't be doing that to save their own behinds. Anyway, I think that the detection of intelligent life probably has already happened. I think that the military has already had encounters, and in fact are blocking any information from the public to prevent the public from contacting them. I talked about this last week. I talked about the shot over the bow, those two comets coming through the solar system, coming through that flare in the sun, one hitting directly. And I know, now this is not James McCanney talking, this is the military high command talking, that they thought that that was a shot over the bow. So anyway, when it comes to, let me just give my own personal opinion on aliens. As a scientist, I don't have any personal proof of any kind that the Earth has ever been visited by aliens. I don't see anything substantial, concrete proof, that is, that aliens have visited this planet, although there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that contact has been made by individuals, by etc. But I understand the technologies that are there to move between the stars. There are some of my own inventions, the magnetic propulsion systems, that have been published in engineering magazines, etc. I've given talks at international propulsion conferences on these topics. It's well known, and one of the designs I have not released. It's a passive design that allows you to move on the electric currents between stars. But at any rate, that's just a little side note on dealing with aliens, but we may have to wait for them to come and contact us. It's very clear that the military wants to be in control. If they do come to contact us, they certainly don't want them talking to you or me, because we would say, hey, you know, let's get rid of all this power structure in this world and get back to something normal and sane, and they might just come in and clean house. And that's what the powers that be are afraid of, that you out there John Public Doe out there would become in contact with aliens and therefore ruin their gig. It's as simple as that. Okay, so enough of that. Let me jump right into the topic of alternative energy update. And as you know, I've written a book. It's called McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project. And first of all, I want to start out with an article that was sent in by a listener on the state of Hawaii. And this is real interesting. Let me pull this up and kind of walk through this article. Okay, so here's the article. It's from the New York Times. It says, "Solar power battle puts Hawaii at forefront of worldwide changes." And they show big racks of solar panels here sitting out with the this is near Honolulu. And so here's the problem. People are paying $700 a month for electricity. How amazing, in a what you might call paradise, the monthly bill is over $700 a month for electricity. So people have started putting solar panels on their house, but they have not been installing batteries. So the purpose of these solar panels is just to produce some energy, and then they have a exchange box where they can put electricity back out onto the grid and sell it. But here's the problem, and this is the problem with any local installation of alternative energy, is that you are selling it back to the, you're buying electricity at the retail price, but you're selling it back to the power company at sub-wholesale prices. So it's really a lose-lose situation. And it's very complicated because the power grid is what you might call centralized. It's expected that the main power source, in this case burning number two diesel fuel and, I understand, coal for the Hawaii Electric Company, they are burning fossil fuels, which, of course, fossil is a misnomer, complete misnomer. These fuels are not made from dinosaur bones, etc. But be that as it may, very expensive. They have to import the fuel, then burn it. And how ludicrous in an area where you have tremendous amounts of sun and wind. And of course, my wing generation, I don't use the word wind generation to get away from all of the tremendously bad wind generation systems that have been put out on the market over the past years. But with all of the wind available energy, they have installed quite a few three-blade systems, banks of these three-blade systems in the Hawaiian Islands, and they don't work. In some cases, the Hawaiian Electric Company has not put in the infrastructure to get the power out. So they sit there idle. Some of them sit there in ruins. In fact, in my picture, I have a picture in my book, some of the installations there that have been sitting there in ruins for decades, rusting away, really ugly, not producing any power at all. So, once the people get the money and run, there's no recourse. The people, a lot of this has been subsidized by the government. But they say in Hawaii now, 12% of the homes have solar panels. That's from this New York Times April 19th article. It's called "Solar Power Battle Puts Hawaii at Forefront of Worldwide Changes." Now, let's play devil's advocate here and say that all of the houses in Honolulu put solar panels on and started developing power. Would that cure the problem there? Well, no, because solar is only during the daytime hours and during peak daytime hours. What happens when all of a sudden it gets cloudy and rains? Well, then the power company has to come online and produce that amount of power. The whole problem is here is that the power company trying to balance the supply of electric with the need of electric they have to balance those so that the voltage stays relatively constant and the amount of current coming in the system is constant, but they don't have any measure of the homes, the amount of energy they're putting out from these individual couple panels here, couple panels there. Or where it's sunny, say that it's a cloudy day with little patches of clouds moving across, but it's a bright sunny day. So these panels are dropping voltage. All of a sudden the sun comes out again or the cloud passes by. All of a sudden they start producing power again. This constant fluctuation makes it nearly impossible for the power companies to maintain a proper level of power. But let's look at and imagine that there was enough solar output in Hawaii to cover all of the solar needs. And the result would be that it still wouldn't work because solar is only during the daytime. The real conflict here is between what I call in my book the centralized versus distributed energy. In the distributed system, it's the exact same problem that occurred when mainframe computers started to attach intelligent devices. And so how did prior to that, if you typed a letter from your keyboard in the old mainframe days of the IBM and the Honeywell, etc., mainframes, if you typed a letter, that signal would go to the mainframe computer, in which would send a signal back to your screen to put that letter on your screen. That's how dedicated the terminals were. They were very dumb. They didn't do anything. They were just basically a keyboard and a screen, and all of the processing, down to even a small putting a letter or a symbol on your screen, had to be processed by the mainframe. Okay, eventually they got intelligent terminals, and the terminal had a certain amount of intelligence. It could store a certain amount of information. You could type a line or two, and then that would go to the mainframe and then be processed. Then they got to the point where this could be, the mainframe could be in New York and the people on the computer were in Texas. And so the transmission of these information back and forth was carried. And as in terms of signaling rates, this is something I worked in for about 15 years of my life in this industry as a senior systems engineer in this industry with encryption. This is where I learned about encryption and encoding, and we designed our own computer chips, etc., and built IBM-compatible front-end processors. These are the computers that offloaded the transmission capability from the mainframes. And so as intelligent computing came along in local area networks where people were communicating on a local area network and nothing really went up to the host computer until a great deal of processing was done, okay, now how did the host computer deal with this? There was a lot of change going on. Eventually you got to the point where you had local computers that had more computing power than the mainframes. And you had hundreds, if not thousands, of these connected. So it was a change, and there was a big fight in the industry, and eventually distributed computing won over, where the processing of information was done at the local terminal, right there at the hands of the person. And so converting all of this, there were people that made great amounts of money, because they were in the industry at the right time and they were able to hire intelligent programmers, et cetera. And they went from the what were called the legacy or the old IBM mainframe style computers to distributed processing. And they would convert all of the applications, et cetera, over. This was a big, big business. It's still a big business maintaining all of this. But the point is that energy is going to go the same way. Eventually, because the centralized processing of energy at the main generator plant, because they have basically created a monster that the people have to get away from, and now people can generate energy at their own house very cost effectively, and maintain it for years and years and decades to come and save all of that money that's going to the electric company, because the electric companies became very inefficient and in some cases greedy. It's simply a system that is going to break down. And as it does, the central power company has to raise rates or put fees on. For example, this article in the New York Times says in Hawaii, to put an installation in your house of solar panels, they charge $182 a year just to have the ability to do that. And so they say that these rates and fees are variable and will change and increase in the future, that the centralized power companies are going to fight the installation of personalized energy systems and use every excuse in the book to prevent it from happening, because basically their business is at stake. As they produce less energy, as the home consumer produces more energy, the operating costs of the power company remain the same or increase. And so they're going to have to charge more and more, not less and less. You think, well, if everybody's producing energy, then the centralized power company will have to produce less, and therefore our rates should go down. And what people are finding out is it's just the opposite. The rates go up. Their monthly rates are actually going to increase. I talked a few weeks ago about the Block Island project off of New Hampshire. They're putting in a series of, starting with three, large, what they call large, they're really not large at all, but three-blade wind generators, and running a cable off for the benefit of a place called Block Island. And then the excess will go off to the shore. So all of the permits are granted, all of the funding is there, they're going to install these, but what they're going to find out is that the rates are going to increase. Everybody's been sold a bill of goods that somehow the rates are going to go down. Well, what's going to happen when those break down, which is going to happen and probably very soon? Power company, the centralized power company, not only has to provide power to make up for that, but it has to sustain equipment out there that doesn't work. So the three-blade wind generators, of which also Hawaii has various installations, it simply doesn't work. And so people, it's very interesting in this article, what's really interesting is they don't even mention wind as an alternative. Now, the wind blows on the ocean, in the Pacific Ocean, day and night, all hours of the day. That would be the logical alternative for energy for a place like the Hawaiian Islands. But at any rate, let's look at the entire problem here, try and encapsulate this entire issue. You have individuals who are desperate for a solution, not only here, but everywhere. The central power companies have a monopoly. If you are in a town, municipality, more than likely that power company has an exclusive contract to distribute energy into your region. And this is all controlled. There are state regulatory agencies. But remember that now the energy company, the telephone company, all of what we used to call utilities, and we still call them utilities, the term utility meant publicly regulated, in other words. But now these are private companies, and so they're vying for business just like the guy selling pots and pans down the street. So the question is, people are desperate. They're putting solar panels on their house. They're looking for a solution. Somebody's trying to sell them a solution that simply is not viable. It's not working. And here's the crux of the issue. I mean, if I said that to people, excuse me, who are selling rooftop solar panels, they'd say, well, obviously, this is a solution. This is helping the customer. There's a 10-year payback, and then they get free energy. But the real problem is here, it doesn't solve anything. In my book, McCanny Wing Generator, The World Energy Project, I have one simple question. And this is the litmus test. It's the golden test for all solutions regarding energy. Will it replace our energy needs 100%? In other words, can you get rid of that centralized power company? And the answer is no. The solution conflicts with the centralized system that is now in existence. The more rooftop solar panels you put in, the worse the situation gets, because at nighttime, at off-peak times, when there's clouds, when it's raining, that power company has to gear up and produce power. And all of their operating expenses are the same or more, and it becomes much more difficult for them to manage the system. There's voltage peaks, there's voltage drops. People with, let's take something simple like a router. A router is, everybody has one in their home, the Wi-Fi unit or whatever. A router is a very common thing today, but a very small drop in voltage, and that router is going to turn off. It's going to recycle. It's going to think that there's a brownout, and it's going to recycle. Okay, that's just one piece of equipment. Power tools, for example. If you do not deliver 110 volts to that power tool, it's going to burn up much faster. It's going to cause a lot of problems for that tool. So regulating voltage, refrigerators, stoves, other equipment around the house, lighting, all of this depends on the stable generation of electricity, the voltage and the current, and it's the product of those two that gives you the power. These are physical equations. But the end result is, do the solutions solve the problem? And the answer is no. The solutions of putting more and more, now let's just get away from the Hawaiian Islands. Let's come back to the mainland U.S. Let's come back to the United States and look at there more and more solar panels being installed. But is that solving the general population problem? Let's take, for example, Elon Musk's company. It's Sun Solar in Solar Sun, whatever, out in California, and they're expanding. They're now worldwide. They even have a solution where you can go off-grid in a local area. You can take your business or you can take your group of houses and put them on a local solar grid system. Well, that sounds like a wonderful idea, but that doesn't we eliminate the expense of running that central power plant that provides power to everyone. It's not a solution. In fact, it creates more problems than it solves. Some people will have cheaper power, but at the expense of the guy down the street who now has to make up the difference, his rates are going to go up because you decided to put in your own little mini power grid. These are not solutions, and eventually it's going to come to what they call loggerheads. That's when two conflicting entities or interests collide and there's no solution. It's at a log jam. The log jam is building up, the logs are piling upriver, and the only thing that's going to happen is a disaster. This is the future. Now, along with this article in the New York Times, I see, and this is the thing, a lot of greenies out there, a lot of tree huggers. Here's a green column in the New York Times that says, outlook for solar gets a bit brighter. And then it's some gee whiz article about how solar energy is going to make things better. The end result is, apply the single litmus test. A single measure of the quality of solution. Will it replace 100% our energy needs? In other words, can you get rid of that centralized energy production facility? And the answer is no for all of these. So these are not solutions. They're band-aids on a gaping wound that's hemorrhaging. And, okay, so you put a little band-aid on your house, you've solved some of the problems at your location, But you've dumped all of those problems on the guy next door. And really, these are going to come back and haunt everybody. We do not have a national energy policy. The national energy policy is a disaster. They're trying to shut down coal plants, and which over the years has become one of the cleaner sources of energy. But none of this is necessary. Coal, they're trying to force everybody onto nuclear. The nuclear power is an absolute disaster in the making. In other words, when the nuclear fuel, I mean, we're going to have nuclear disasters in the world that are going to kill off basically the entire world population. We've already had one. It's called Fukushima. They're trying to cover up the results of Fukushima by saying that, oh, there's a blob of heat in the Pacific Ocean, and that's what's killing off the animals of the Pacific Ocean. Total absurdity. The amount of denial in the energy industry is incredible because the energy industry is literally the largest industry in the world. Wars are fought over it. Conflicts, ongoing manipulation, control of the public. The list is just incredible. And energy is the dominant commodity in the world today. Russia splitting off and selling out of the petrol dollar, other countries joining, and what we have is a political, economic, worldwide disaster in the making. Right now, well, yeah, I'm not going to go into politics, but the entire issue of energy, when you go to solve the energy problem of the world, you have to solve the entire energy problem of the world. And like I said in my book, The Wing Generator, the solution is to replace these centralized units, which are running between 500 and 800 megawatt generation of power per unit, per coal or per nuclear plant. You have to produce energy on that level to have a significant impact on the world energy situation, and you have to replace all of them. Replacing one here and over there isn't going to work. So, once again, the world situation in energy has a solution. Now, every Wednesday, John Moore asks me when I'm a guest on his show, he says, Jim, what's the update on the Wing Generation Project? Here is the basic issue. Any solutions are going to be blocked. And trying to work these into the world population is basically a juggling act. It's a very difficult thing to do because you're competing with energy sources that are already established, no matter what they are. We should have been on electric systems ages ago, but as far as the Wing project itself, developing the product is one part, is an engineering project, etc. It's an engineering project, but implementing it and getting it in place and then replacing the world centralized energy sources and adapting the modern grid that we have to distributed energy is another part of the problem. Okay, in my book, I talk about distributed energy, and this is exactly the same problem that was seen when converting from mainframe computers to distributed computing, where the application, where the user had an intelligent machine, and the majority of the processing went on in the localized computer at the hands of the user. And now we don't even think about mainframe computers. We don't even consider them because even though there are massive computers in the world today, massive computers which are doing the processing, etc., but the bulk of processing today is in distributed computing. You put the intelligence, and so if your computer is not doing much, you're wasting your own local resources. But you're not wasting the resources of some common entity. That, in the old days of legacy mainframe computing, was an issue. was to keep the data coming in so that computer was busy a good deal of the time. You didn't want that big mainframe sitting there idle because it was expensive. It was billed in terms of dollars per computing second. And so you had to keep that computer busy. That meant a lot of planning. There was a lot of planning that went into staging the computer program so that they were constantly running. One would get done, the other one would start. Without downtime with that central processor unit. In the modern world, we don't really consider. If you're sitting there typing, just take an example. Say you're typing a letter in your very fast typist, and you're just typing information into your local laptop. The amount of CPU usage that you're using is absolutely minimal. It's not even 1%. It's not even 0.1%. Typing and processing the information from typing. Extremely small amount of usage of that computer. In fact, a very poor use of that computer, but we do it all the time and don't think anything of it. We turn off our computer. It might sit for 8 or 10 hours, might sit for 2 days before you use it again. In the world of energy, distributed energy is somewhat the same, but here's the situation. You don't control the voltage and current levels at the central processing unit, at the central energy production unit. You manage the voltage and the current at the end user location. So now the power can fluctuate on the line. It can go up. It can go up to 150 volts. It can go down to 60 volts. It doesn't matter. A lot of people don't understand this concept. Let me take an example of an LED flashlight, something that we all use. They're dependent on a very constant voltage. But as the battery drops down in power, as you use your battery, the voltage on the battery is dropping and dropping and dropping. So say it's a 1.5 volt battery. By the time you're down to the battery is almost expended, you might be down to near a volt instead of a volt and a half. But you need to keep providing the same amount of voltage to that LED light to keep it lit at this brilliant light. The same with, let's take an automobile. Let's say you have a nice brand new Tesla automobile, sports car, high performance. The voltage that goes to the motor, the electric motor in the car, has to maintain a certain voltage. And so anyway, what happens is even though the battery source is dropping in voltage, you have a conversion circuit that takes power. As the voltage drops, it takes more current, and now you can provide the same voltage and current level to the end device. In the case of the flashlight, it's the light bulb. In the case of the Tesla car, it's the engine. It's the electric motor. And so if you understand this principle, the voltage and current on the line are not what would be important. What is important is you have a unit at the end, a distribution unit, right at the user interface at the house or at the local transformer, and that's where you change that voltage and maintain 110 volts, or in the case of 220, you would maintain a 220 volt and then the proper current level to go to the users. And now you don't have to worry. If that guy down there in house A has solar panels, guy at house B has a wind generator on his roof, the guy at house C doesn't have any, but he's a big electric user, it doesn't matter because now your local control is a smart, intelligent device at the local level. And it doesn't matter what the next block is doing, or the next town over, or the next city 50 miles away. You don't have to maintain the voltage and current level on the grid. So this whole concept, this is what I'm saying, we need somebody with some intelligence to sit down and create a national program. And now this is not a smart grid. A smart grid that they're talking about, this is the Obama smart grid and some other people, They are talking about a smart grid with intelligence that would distribute energy. Now, this would be something where they measure your electric use at your house, feed it back into a system, and then control the energy from there. And so if you turn on a toaster, which you might even be prohibited from doing, they say between 10 in the morning and 9 at night, you can't make toast. You can't cook a meal. You can't take a hot shower. You can't wash clothes. They're going to tell you all the things you cannot do because that makes their life easier at the distribution end. The point of all of this is when you start putting the wing generators, which convert wind energy very efficiently, no matter what the wind velocity is, and you start dumping this energy into the national grid. The wind might be blowing heavily out in the Pacific Ocean off of San Diego, but not very much off of New Hampshire. So what you're doing is you have generator units all over the country that are dumping energy into the system. That energy is flowing because at a higher voltage in this grid, you allowed it to flow into a region that has lower voltage. And the control, the final control of the voltage and the current to provide the local houses, the local businesses, is done at those locations. But you have to have an energy policy that's coordinated nationally, and you need somebody with some intelligence to do this. You can't rely on a president who's mainly interested in global control. And the whole purpose of the smart grid is to control you so that if you're not a good boy or girl or a good citizen according to their standard, you get cut off. Just like my web page, access to my web page, I'm not a good corporate citizen according to the CIA who controls Google, who obviously is controlling Verizon. And so they cut off your services. That's what you get for not complying with them. You understand that properly put a national energy policy into place, first of all, you have to understand that you got to get rid of the centralized power production plants the way they're situated now, with centralized control. With the voltage and the current controlled at the central office, you cannot have, it's really not going to work. The more people you bring online with solar panels, wind generation, other local electrical gen systems, it's not going to work. It's just going to cause conflicts. And so because the system we have today is not set up for it. But more than that, it's causing economic strife within the centralized power plants, the centralized generation locations, the coal, the nuclear, and in many cases, like the remote places, you have number two diesel fuel being burned for electric generation. What a terrible waste. Now, I also talk in my book about the inefficiency of the burning high energy content fuels. Oil, coal, nuclear is, after you get done, and now you have to include the overhead, the cost of overhead of the facility, and that includes retirement accounts, investments of those companies, all of the other things, the actual cost, they're at most about 15% efficient. So you're not simply talking about the physical energy conversion process. You have to put all of the overhead on top of that, of running that particular facility. So the energy cost, the true efficiency of, say, a nuclear or coal-generated power plant, is at most 15%. In some cases, probably less than 5%. Now you distribute it. Now it gets to the end user. Now it goes through an electric motor that's around 30% efficient, or an electric light bulb, which is about, for the newer type, it might be 70% efficient. For the older incandescent light bulbs, it was 5% efficient. You start multiplying these efficiencies together, like 0.3, 0.05, 0.25. And you have about four or five of these factors together. By the time you get done multiplying them together for the true efficiency of this system, you find out that just because of the physical laws here, that's called the Carnot cycle, just because of the actual physical limitations, you're running at around 1% to possibly maximum 5% efficiency of the energy you're burning. So you have a coal fire plant. Okay, measure the amount of heat that comes out of that plant. Take 5% of it. That's the amount of energy that's actually being used by the end user. Now let's look at automobiles. They talk about green automobiles being electric. If you're burning coal or nuclear power and eventually you plug your car in at your home or wherever you plug it in, and that energy is coming from coal or nuclear power, that's a tremendously expensive energy source, a tremendously expensive and inefficient. You would be much better off simply burning the gasoline in terms of actual cost. So the only way electric use is going to become efficient and actually work is if we start replacing the coal and nuclear and oil, petroleum-based fired power plants and replace them with wing generators one by one. And this is a wing generator that is sufficiently large to replace them one by one. So you're talking 500 megawatts to a gigawatt of power per unit. And so if you count the number of nuclear power plants is about 170 in the United States, and we have many, many hundreds of coal-fired plants in the United States, but every day you have to get the fuel and burn it, and once you burn that fuel, you have to get more. The issue with the wing generator is once you set it up, you have years and years, literally, of converting wind energy, something that's already there, which, by the way, is an electrical offshoot of the electrical system in the solar system. It's a byproduct. Wind is a direct result of the electrical nature of our solar system. If we didn't have the solar capacitor to move the upper ionospheric streams, which move the jet streams, which move the lower stream wind systems on Earth, if it weren't for that electrical system capacitor built up in the solar system, we wouldn't have wind at all. So literally, this is a form of electrical power, converting electrical energy in the solar system into wind energy. You take that wind energy very efficiently, convert it into electrical energy, but at the location. You have these in large systems that generate the power. But now what are you doing? You're eliminating that 25% efficiency Carnot cycle from the whole process. Now you're dealing with converting wind energy to electric, directly to electric, which is about 95% efficient. Just imagine, now we're not burning the high-content fuels anymore, we're distributing this energy onto the national grid. We don't have to control the voltage and the current from the central points. We don't even care about that. All we care about is that there's enough energy to cover the physical needs of the society, and then the voltage and current are established locally. This is distributed energy. The reason I'm going through this is because the energy policy of the United States and the free world is an absolute disaster. As people look desperately for solutions, as they look desperately for and start implementing things like putting on rooftop solar panels, etc., which are not going to solve the problem, they're not going to give us a final solution. And eventually, once people realize, now I mentioned in this article about in the New York Times dealing with Hawaii, never once do they mention wind generation, because wind generation has been thoroughly defamed by the many companies, General Electrics, the other companies in the world, the Siemens, for example, who do not, their solutions are non-solutions. This is another thing I talk about in my book, is the myth of alternative energy. And I'm not going to repeat that here, but very simply, that the alternative energy solutions that have been produced and put off on the public are not solutions. And any real solution is going to be blocked. So at any rate, just a simple update on the wing generation development and progress. One thing, like I say, is the engineering part. That's the easy part. Building a generation system that's 100, 200, 300 feet tall and hooking it to generators and hooking it into the grid, that's not the problem. All of that is simple engineering. I wouldn't say it's simple, but it's simply engineering. That's not the problem. Getting it implemented and put in place to where you can eventually completely eliminate the coal, the nuclear, and the other hydrocarbon form base of high heat content fuels, that's the problem. That is the problem, the entire crux of the problem, and not only with these companies, but because energy is used as a worldwide control source. Many nations depend on that income for their livelihood. And so even if a country had a disposition to be green or whatever, they're not going to do it because many of the poor countries today are actually exporting oil or oil derivatives, and that's a big money, that's possibly their only cash cow in their entire society, in the entire political structure of that country. So changing all of this over is going to be a long, laborious process. That's what I'm saying. The solution is there. Trying to get it implemented is the problem. So the final question then is, what solution is there? Now, I want you to read the Wing Generator book. It's available on my webpage. But I go through all of the various alternative forms of energy, and what every one of them, I show why they will not be a solution. So in spite of the fact that, for example, solar has a great surgence of installation, it's really not a solution that's going to take over and replace that central power plant. If it were, it probably would be blocked with a lot more vigor. But the fact that solar panels, people are putting their investment in this, they only have so much money to invest in alternative energy, it's not a solution. So it's really a good thing for the main power companies and the people that control power in the world, because it's not a solution. People are spending their resources marching down the wrong road. And that's what the people in power love to see. They love to see people, and they'll create false controversies. Oh, the Hawaiian Electric versus the citizens, and they'll have that go in the courts for years and burn up everybody's time and money. And when the people finally get their two solar panels on their roof, it's not a solution because they're buying electrical energy at retail rates and they're selling it back at sub-wholesale rates. Not exactly a good plan. Whereas if they just would use those solar panels to power their own needs, and most of them in a place like Hawaii where you have air conditioning, which is one of the big hogs of electric, you're probably not going to generate enough electricity from solar power to cover your air conditioning costs. In fact, it would be pretty well safe to say that the average roof doesn't have enough space for the amount of electric you need to generate to run your air conditioning, and then it only works when the sun is shining. If it's raining, it doesn't work, or at nighttime, it doesn't work. So, according to the article, and this is also understandable, that the people are not building home-based systems that are complete systems. They're simply putting a couple solar panels up there, trying to sell back some energy to the electric company, but they're not storing. They don't have any batteries. They don't have inverters. They don't have any distributed intelligent equipment at their home location. So it's once again, the type of system they're selling is not any kind of solution at all, not a real solution. It makes the people feel good, possibly, that maybe someday they'll get some cost benefit back. But when you're paying $700 a month for an electric bill, you're going to have to produce a lot of electricity and sell it back at sub-wholesale prices to make up that $700. I mean, your average house simply doesn't have enough area to generate $700 worth of electricity at wholesale prices per month. Simply isn't going to happen. So from that example, you can see the solutions that are being sold to these poor people are not solutions. They're taking people's money and selling them a bill of goods. I guess that's the only way you can say it. Okay, so I'm going to cut that short. I'm going to talk for the last couple of minutes about the new DVD number 4. I just want to keep people reminded of that. It's the first of many DVD courses, and these are very high-level detailed courses. It's something that I had to do. I know these are not going to be New York Times bestseller list, but I encourage people to start. This is the equivalent of the Encyclopedia Britannica for college-level astronomy. This is the material that in 100 years is going to be taught at the university level, and that's another reason I'm doing this, is because no one on this planet has this level detail information, and I'm the creator of this material. The electrical universe, the way the sun powers our solar system, down to our weather, down to how it interacts with you as human beings, all of this is extremely intricate, and so that's why it's going to take about 15 or 16 DVDs of 7-hour lectures plus problem sets, etc., to really put out this level of information. So go to the web page, go to the secure web ordering page, and once again, DVD number 4. The books, my books, CDs, DVDs, etc., are required reading. So this, once again, I'm not going to repeat what's already in those books. Also, look at the other various items. By the way, if you order more than $400 worth of products of any combination from the webpage, you get that DVD number 4 course for free. Also, the water filter products, which are always there, the GF filters, which take out everything without any add-on filters, those now being produced in the United States, the emergency sun calendar clock, the recalendar sun star clock, the posters, all of the items there, very important information. And I'm about out of time once again. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.